There is this thing.
Do you realize
what is?
There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing
on.
There is this thing going on.
What
do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Special two-hour broadcast exploring the theme of racial profiling. I'm Shiraz Janjua, and co-hosting today's show is Shannon Lawrence.
Hi.
Hi.
How are you doing?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm good.
So over the next 2 hours, we're going to be speaking to community activists. We're going to be talking to youth. We're going to hear about their testimonies dealing with racial profiling versus the police of Montreal. And maybe first off, we can speak to Anita of Head and Hands, who's going to kind of broach the topic of racial profiling and give a context to why we're here and why it's important to talk about this right now.
Hey, I guess, yeah, the history of doing these radio shows was birthed. I'm a street worker. I work in the street. We work with youth at Head and Hands. And we were noticing a lot of altercations between police and youth that had a racist context. Essentially, cops were stopping a lot of black kids, Latinos, kids that weren't white, or kids that were dressed within like the hip-hop subculture. Mm-hmm. And this was really alarming to us. Also, too, in talking to youth, a lot of them had altercations with police that they felt was based on their race. And so we just felt we needed to do something about it. So we started to talk to other, I guess, organizations within the community of NDG and see if we could, I guess, like stir something up. And the resistance was really intense. People either didn't feel that it was important or, you know, the cops were just like, listen, what are you talking about? This is ridiculous. So the reality was so different. So we decided that we needed to do some sort of community action in order to, you know, make space for the voices of especially youth, but also to just different community members, because it's just, yeah, the two realities were so different. It was alarming.
So where are you seeing these events taking place? You said that there are all these altercations that are taking place between youth and the police. Where is that happening?
We see it mostly at the metros. There was a point, it's actually chilled out this year, so maybe the work that we're doing is working, but before you would see like a line of police right after the turnstile. So in order to take the metro, you'd have to go through this wall of cops, and then they would just like pick people off, and it was just totally insane, you know? Or we'd be hanging out at the metro and we'd see cops approach specific kids for like loitering or whatever. And it's really funny because my job as a street worker is to actually like sit in a space for long periods of time, and I've never been approached by a cop. I'm white, I'm over 25, but at the same time, you know, they would just like go to these kids like magnets, and they're getting tickets, you know, they're getting pretty hefty fines. And some of the problem, too, is that they get these tickets and then they don't feel that they can go home and tell their parents because they'll get in trouble. So the tickets aren't getting paid. And then it's possible that warrants come up for their arrests. So then there's larger problems in the future. So it's just all around bad.
I think, yeah, I mean, when I first moved to Montreal, what I noticed that was really strange was the amount of police that I noticed in the metro stations. And I am from Toronto originally, and I could not understand why. And I remember seeing once an interaction between a police officer and a guy, like probably he was like 16, 17. And I didn't understand what this was about. I just like saw a kid going through the metro turnstile to get on the metro, and I couldn't figure it out, but I remember it disturbing me, and I remember just observing it for a little while and being just really disturbed by what I was watching. And I think it had to do with the fact that he didn't have his student card with his Metro Pass kind of thing, but it was just like, I don't know, I've heard a couple stories of that and of kids being stopped and questioned about that. And anyone that I have actually ever spoken to about that has been someone who's a minority, who's like a visible minority that's been stopped. But I just remember watching it go down, and it was disturbing just to even kind of walk by it.
Yeah. And then when we try and talk to the police about it, they're just, they're basically kind of in denial, or they try and bridge it to kind of the gang phenomena, which is also really dangerous too, because when we talk to different community members or we talk about like youth and gangs, a lot of it is attached to youth of color. You know, I never hear anybody like, oh, what are we going to do about the white kids who are possibly going to become bikers? You know, like I've never had that conversation. But it's always about, you know, kids, like black kids selling crack or, you know, like whatever. Like it's just ridiculous, these huge stereotypes. And it's really damaging, you know. It's, you can tell when you have conversations with youth about their relationships with police, and just this racism. It's just, there's just, they're tired, you know, and it's just this huge uphill battle. And I'm worried about, like, just this constant, like, how does this affect their ability to stay focused mm-hmm. and to obtain goals, you know? And we can also, we're talking about this in a context that's broader than cops too, you know, in schools, counselors, social workers, other youth workers, you know, we hear stories from kids who go and talk about, you know, what their future could be with their school counselors. And they're just like, oh, you want to go to university? Maybe that's not a good idea. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe yeah. you should go into a trade. And it's bullshit. It's not okay.
So where does Head in Hands come into play in all this? What do you do in Head in Hands?
Well, we have a really holistic approach, so we try, like, as a base, just to look at each person as an individual. Also, we try and stay current with things. So, since we heard that this was a problem, we started radio shows. We sit on what's called the Table de Concertation de Jeunesse in NDG. We've tried to bring it up with them. We tried to do a series of, like, kind of, like, anti-oppression workshops with the police. We brought CRAR in to talk to the issue. It was a total joke, though. It actually started more of a fight within the community than like any kind of a solution. But then we also heard that there were some schools, some secondary schools, mainly, well, St. Luke as an example, in NDG, where a lot of kids of color weren't necessarily getting to Sec 5. And then we also heard some racist comments coming, or like rumors of racist comments coming from teachers, but also too, they have like what's called welcoming classes. So kids that are either new immigrants mm-hmm. or for some reason are put in welcoming classes. And teachers were having concerns, saying they were concerned about like the black and Filipino youth. So a table started about it. So we're sitting on that table and trying to kind of figure out what it's all about, first of all, and then see where we can go with that. But I think one of our coordinators, Neil, actually sits on that table, and maybe he can talk about that later.
All right, well, we'll love to speak to him about that in the coming minutes of the show. Let's see, how are we doing for time? Maybe we'll play a little bit of music, and then after that, we're going to hear some interviews that were done with youth talking about racial profiling, hearing what they have to say and what testimonies they can give about the subject.
I live on the block where dudes bust they knocks. Mm-hmm. Right on top of the car, they crush they rocks. Like niggas hop my fence to run from cops. Shit, I'm a nigga too, so I know a niggas do. Keep it real, you should let that bullshit silence. You only been involved in domestic violence, nigga. I chase Remy's with Long Islands. Catch us in the club, doing them wrong. Wild like the phone marvelous, Marvin Hagler. It's obvious in the lobby,
suavely dressed with a party is. Round trip flight to LaGuardia. Nobody guards when we walk through the audience. Dolo with Modo, with Blow though, for show though. Slide one deep in the photo. Hold though, catch me rocking a Lisa Lobo. Bump yo ho and won't pause for the photo.
And the Pope can't save your soul, but I'm bold. Was written in gold, hieroglyphic Egyptian scroll. Streets I've been in from the beginning. I'm a legend, never fleeing from my enemies. Shots I'm sending, musical martyr like John Lennon from the beginning. Spit with a vengeance, semi-automatic weapon, repping Comstock, warlock like David Geffen, blowing ox like oxygen out of my nostrils. Seen brave men fight for their honor and even die. Two gorgeous divas blowing the heaters down the ride to the ends of the earth through hell, water and fire. Queen's Messiah, camouflage black attire, magnum opus, top five dead or alive. The feds focus, my militants swerving the lotus, Marsburg and the hostess. I write it then release it, then I bless the street, giving birth to soldiers. Rose gold, King Tut peace, flooded with boulders. I praise the law, make it Salah facing the east. This is for the black and white baby starving to eat. Think differently.
Poverty stricken, fried chicken, fly rhyme kicking, blind visions from the minds, wisdom in this crime religion. Niggas listen, what I'm spitting is hard as prison benches in the trenches. Grim intentions, twin Doberman pinches, leather trenches, lead trenches for bread, endless gats, 11 inches. Your neck slitted, your head spinning, the epidemic will spread infinite. So once the threat is knitted for seven digits, it's just business, no disrespect intended to he who feel offended. A beatdown cannot be prevented. Beginning the game, I'm deep in it until my Yankee fitted. Squish three Lee Haney niggas, squeeze the 80 triggers. Used to fuck my babysitters, now I whip Mercedes Benzes. I stand alone cause I'm grown. Don't need to crush the walk, no gang, love or support of any sort. When I'm in New York, rolling for Dolo. The Willy Bobo got a Dobo, word to Jomo. The kid in the polo got the world on the yo-yo. Your Happy Meal skills, still no frills. Cook frills, sign deals, you see me, Jesse Neal. Oil whopping meals, your hospital bill. Blood from your nostrils spills, not looking well. When I lick off shots, the hostages yell. Chop the frail like oxtail, your optics swell.
Ninjas with blades raised from jungles of wolves and hoods. Where hammers barking and tennis spark, police on radar, so we stay far duck, puffing blunt, sipping goose, and damage, God damn, it's hard. But still, we get by like rhinos, ones that peel, crucified on the earth for guns and nails. 9 inches hurt, I caught stitches, Bill with guards on track, suffering visible scars, it's hard to relax, ready to spaz, knowing we thirst for cash, time's moving fast, we like cheetahs with masks, laying cheaper and hash, trying to balance the steps, screaming. We need freedom, tired of bleeding where eagles let out evil. Talents of death, no time for weakness. Higher heights to reach, advance the concrete with iron feet.
Ok, c'est au moins. Exact, c'est quoi pour moi exactement? C'est, disons que une personne québécoise ou une personne noire, peu importe la religion ou peu importe la race qu'il est, que moi, qui n'est pas la même race que moi, exemple comme asiatique, laotien plutôt, mais si par exemple que je rentre au magasin ou sinon je vais au restaurant, quelque chose comme ça, puis le noir il me dit, oh, je veux pas d'asiatique ici, ou sinon c'est juste des noirs que je veux comme ça. Ça pour moi c'est une affaire raciale, quelque chose de ce genre là. Mais c'est sûr que côté si par exemple t'es toujours victime d'un côté racial, c'est sûr que c'est plate parce que tu sais, genre tu es toujours dominé par le monde, puis le monde sont toujours contre toi, ça c'est sûr que c'est plate pour tu sais. Mais comme moi je peux pas vraiment dire de mon côté que je connais, parce que j'ai pas encore vécu ce moment-là, mais c'est sûr que si je fais à la place de quelqu'un d'autre, c'est sûr que ça tape pour la personne, tu sais.
Ok, pourquoi tu penses que le profilage racial existe?
Mais parce qu'on veut éliminer ça, on veut que moins de monde haïsse entre côté d'autres couleurs, peu importe, tu sais, comme on dit jaune, rouge, noir, peu importe, tu sais, c'est sûr qu'on essaie d'avoir ça pour éliminer le plus possible le côté racial.
Qu'est-ce que tu penses qu'on devrait faire pour arrêter ça complètement? Est-ce que ça se peut?
Mais tu sais, à Montréal, c'est beaucoup moins pire qu'il y a peut-être 10 ans de ça, tu sais. So, comme si on voit comme avant, c'est sûr que c'était beaucoup plus pire que maintenant. T'sais, on peut pas, c'est sûr qu'on peut pas éliminer de A à Z. Ça, c'est comme exemple un policier qui travaille dans, comme être policier, lui son but c'est de pas qu'il y ait des crimes. Mais tu sais, il y a des pleins de policiers qui savent qu'ils peuvent pas arrêter les crimes. T'sais. C'est une affaire que oui ça va diminuer, mais ça va pas diminuer à 100%. T'sais. Mais tu sais, moi aussi je l'espère que le côté racial ça va comme diminuer beaucoup, parce que maintenant c'est peut-être que de ce que je vois les jeunes ou quoi, peu importe, comme qu'ils soient abusés par d'autres mondes plus que lui, ça c'est peut-être pour la personne. C'est sûr que moi j'aimerais ça que ça baisse ce pourcentage de racial là d'ici 5-10 ans peut-être.
You can go to me then we'll, yeah.
Welcome back to CKUT on 90.3 FM and on ckut.ca on the internet. We're doing a special live broadcast from the Jeunesse 2000 Youth Drop-In Center in NDG, where we're exploring the theme of racial profiling. And now we're going to speak to Neil, who's a coordinator here at the Jeunesse 2000 Youth Center, about his views and his experiences about racial profiling.
Yes.
Hi, Neil. How's it going?
Pretty good. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right.
Yeah.
So, yeah, what do you guys experience here, kind of on the day-to-day? What's it like at the drop-in center?
Well, basically, we have our age group is from like 12 to 17. Sometimes we get the alumni who's a little over 17. And basically, the youths come through. We open from 3 to 8. They come through after school or whatever, whether they work on. They just hang out, play games, play video games. We talk. We have a music room. Some of them access the music, do a little rap, make some beats, and watch movies. It's basically a home away from home, you know? Come off the street and come out of the cold.
A place just to come hang out.
Yeah.
And I guess in your experience here working with kids and interacting with them, what kind of stories have you heard from them, their experiences with, I mean, racial profiling, with police, just confrontations throughout the day?
Well, it's definitely something that is present, you know. I mean, when we talk about racial profiling, oftentimes people think only coming from the police, but from what I see, it's a systematic thing. So they feel it from their schools, from their teachers, not fairly treated, you know, being picked on by the teachers, you know, and just like people in the public, you know, just the way they're looked at and things, because it's very subtle and sometimes it's very obvious. And when you're a person of color, you know, you face it in so many ways. I mean, a little way like you could be the first in line. I mean, this has happened to me. You could be the first in line at a bus stop, and the bus driver stops before you and let the other person in before you. Or you could be at the cashier and you could be the next person in line and the cashier lets somebody else slip through and doesn't say anything, and then you're supposed to not say anything. You know, it's to me is the fact that so many people allow it to happen, you know, because I think we have to be accountable, because it's a racist system that we're living in. And this country was established on racism.
I agree with you absolutely, because yeah. I think it's that sleight of hand that allows it to perpetuate. It only takes one person, I guess, to say something for us to become aware, or for a person to become aware of what they could be doing. But you're right, if everyone just kind of sits back.
Yeah, and say, no, we're not taking this anymore. I mean, everybody can rally around and say, you know, no to the police and things like that, because the police are the obvious enforcers, you know, with their guns and their dogs or the pepper spray or whatever, you know. But what about the institutions like the school guidance council? I've heard too many stories about, you know, youths being discouraged from their full potential. Or going to hospitals and not getting fairly treated, you know, when you're a black person, a person of color, you know. And I think those things are even more significant in the way that they're like hidden, you know. They're not hidden to us, but, you know.
I think I agree with you as well, because as well as thinking about it in terms of Canada and the United States, mm-hmm. and people are very quick to speak of the United States and the differences that exist in the society, and I think that Canadians and the general outlook that Canadians have of themselves, and that people of the world over think of Canada, is that we're accepting and we're multicultural, and mm-hmm. that's our slogan, you know, for Canada. We're a multicultural society, and I think it's so subtle in Canada, racism, that it's almost harder to combat because of the subtleties and where it exists and how it exists.
It's like it doesn't have a face.
Right. And it's so ingrained at the same time.
Yeah.
But that's, for me, one of the issues and the questions that I struggle with is, like, how do you combat something that people don't even admit exists?
Yeah. Like, for example, going for a job and being told constantly that you're overqualified, you know, but you got the interview because they're impressed by your CV, but when they see your face, they wish it wasn't so.
Yeah, or even, I mean, even names on CVs and stuff. I remember when my uncle was having his first child and we were discussing names for the baby, and he was reluctant towards some names because he's like, oh, no, you know, people will see that name and they'll think that's a black name. And I looked at him and I was like, what are you talking about? Like, you're nuts. But it was, like, actually something that he thought of. I would have never thought of that, like, when naming my child, but he was really reluctant as to, like, the name that he gave his daughter because he didn't want her to be, like, prejudged before even entering a situation, which struck me as really odd at the time and kind of sad.
Same thing happened to me, actually.
It did?
Yeah, when I was with my son.
Sorry, this is Ken Taka that's just cutting in here now. And do you want to tell us a bit about that experience?
Well, I just wanted to add, because when I had my son, this was my first child, I always said all my children would have African names. And because I'm of Jamaican ancestry, my parents are from Jamaica, when I had my child and my family members came to the hospital, they said, well, you're going to name him a Jamaican name, aren't you? I said, well, what's a Jamaican name? And they said, well, you know, because I wanted to name him West African, since I know I'm of West African extraction, as of most of the people from the Caribbean are. And when they said, they heard his first name, they said, okay, it's not bad, because his father is West African, his father is Nigerian, and, you know, his middle name can be, you know, more Jamaican, because, and two of my family members expressed some reluctance, because they said, well, you know, by hearing his first name, Enatama, you know, and it's pronounced Enatama, because, you know, because of the phonetics of the language that it comes from. And they said, well, this is just a little bit too much, because what if that's on a CV? What if that's on a resume? They said, what kind of thing are you setting him up for? His life is going to be too hard. And, you know, this was some of the first experiences I had after having my child a couple of hours after. Instead of being, you know, congratulated, I was being harassed to call my child an African name. You know, and also the middle name was not supposed to be African. It was supposed to be Jamaican, which means British, which, you know, doesn't really make any sense, you know. So I just wanted to cut in from you, because I was laughing because I just had the experience about 11 months ago.
No, absolutely. I mean, I just thought it was a bizarre thing, because I never would have thought about it. But then, you know, my uncle sits there and he says to me, he's like, well, Shannon, and I have a very British name. My mom is born in London, and my name's Shannon Claire Lawrence. Like, and he's like, you have a nice, you know, Western British.
Solid.
Yeah. And I was just like, this
access
is...
access to resources. And
really. But then it doesn't matter, because as you said, like, you know, you look good on paper, and then you walk into a room, and all of a sudden there's a reason why, perhaps, like, you're not... necessarily you're not fitting the bill. So
it's the same thing like your haircut or your dress code, you know. I remember the first time when I start locksing up, you know, the family has problems with it, because they, first of all, they have problem with Rasta, you know, because Rasta is dealing with roots and the African heritage and fighting oppression and colonization. That's really what it stands for. And they say, well, you're not going to be able to get a job. And my feeling is, like, when I had a flat top or a box cut, I got harassed. When I had an afro, I got harassed. When I grew locks, it's the same thing. Actually, I feel less harassed being harassed.
I was just going to ask you if you feel less.
You know, because I think more than anything else is really accepting your heritage. And you know, it's just like black women perming their hair. You know, because you couldn't get a job as a black woman if your hair wasn't permed back in the day, to the point now that people take it as a standard. By the time you're 12 years old, most of them have their hair pressed out.
Maybe 5.
You know what I mean? Yeah. And all that thing about complexion, you know, like you're too dark, you're too light, you know, all these are profiling maybe amongst ourselves, but, you know, it extends outwards too, you know. So racial profiling to me is very, very deep, because it's really, it's white supremacy, really.
I agree there, but also, I mean, just in terms of what you said a little bit earlier about it's not necessarily by, like, the police or an outside group. It happens a lot within communities as well. Mm-hmm. And I think just on that note of, like, too light, too dark, things like that, I mean, I've experienced that, like, when I was in grade school, mm-hmm. when I was 13, 14 maybe, with girls in my grade school. And it really makes you question, like, where you fit in and how you're supposed to fit in. And anyways, it's just... I don't even know really my feelings on it just yet, but
it's when communities
I think divide themselves internally, it just really sets the tone then for outside forces to really come in.
But I think, you know, like speaking of that, I think that was set from the outside in the first place, really, to have communities divided.
Centuries
really
ago.
You know, it's a long time this has been going on, you know, like in native language, the word prison does not exist, you know. So we're just trying to break it down. And the only way you can break it down is really to deal with the issues, because the healing must begin. But we must first diagnose what the problem is. And the problem is not only the police, but the problem is the system, the mentality, the curriculum, the education, and the way one see themselves.
And what are your suggestions for the solution?
Black history.
Yeah.
Better diet. Spirituality. Like, but true history, because all that encompasses that, you know. And I think once we have those things, then we start respecting ourselves, and then we start respecting others, and respecting other traditions. And that's basically, I think, what the problem is. We're living in a capitalist society where the status quo is imperialism, you know, and we're still fighting it today. You know, look at all the clothes that we're wearing. You know, this is prison uniform. This is the prisoners they used to make denim for, you know, and denim is in style. So we all in jail. You know, it's deeper than a color. It's deeper than color, but definitely black is the significant, because black is the first. So, you know, the Constantine and the Roman emperor, they, when they took over Christianity, it was that they can conquer the world with white supremacy, because that's what they did.
Can I ask you, have you ever, like, had any direct experiences?
Racial profiling?
Yeah.
Yes.
Do you want to share them with us, or one of them with us?
Back in 97, December 97, coming back from LaSalle, took the 105 bus coming down on Sherbrooke. Police pull up alongside the car. Woman police looked into the bus, looked at me, gave me the most evilest look. I said, why is she looking at me like that? I said, forget it, you know. It was cold outside, and I was happy to be on the bus because I was going to catch my last train to go downtown where I was living at the time. I didn't even get to Vendôme Metro, right around where the taxi stand is. The police pulled the 105 bus over, like how they would pull you over, you know. On walked the bus, the woman police, probably not the same police woman, with her gun out to her side, screaming, put your hands up!
At you.
Well, my name's not put your hands up, so I didn't think she was talking to me. You know, there was only another woman in the back of the bus, and she's... cop is looking at me with the most murderous look in her eyes. She looked scared, but she looked like she was ready to kill me. So now I'm scared. I said, all right, put my hands up. But why is your gun out? I asked. No response. Then other police start boarding the bus. The bus driver was a black man. He started asking the other police, well, what's going on? I said to them, well, tell them. Please tell them where I got on, because too many times before the police have stopped me and said, you match the description of a purse snatcher. You match the description of a man just beat up his wife on this street and that street, you know? So to me, it was an exercise. They eventually pulled me off the bus, right? Put the handcuffs on me, put me in the back of the cruiser. Up to now, I don't know why they stopped me. I'm asking, like, why do you really stop me? They can't answer me. There was 9 other police cars around Vendôme. To me, it's just an exercise of force. First of all, to put in people's mind that, black, you're still a criminal. Because nobody's going to do anything, you know? I tried to get some support from CKUT. Adrian Hillwood at the time, he called me back. He was in Ottawa. CRSG, which I did some work at Concordia, they tried to help me. I called up this lawyer, this Haitian lawyer. She said she didn't want to touch the case. Mm. I spoke to Rob Laurie at CTV. He said he wanted to do the story. Tell me, call him back a couple of days. I called him back a couple of days. He said, hold on there. He came back. He said, sorry, I spoke to my editor. I can't touch the story. Because no blood run, you know?
Right.
my brother and I go into New York. An uncle passed away in Queens. Took the Greyhound or whatever that bus is. Everybody on their fingerprint, my brother and I, and took our picture. This is like 2 years ago. You know, I guess we were the only ones who looked like Taliban, fit the description of Taliban at the time, you know. And the thing is that what that does to people is like, after that happened, and you go back on the bus, even the black people don't even want to look at you, the older black folks, because, well, he must be a gangster, he must be a criminal. Because it's constantly in people's mind. It's being reminded by the media. You know what I mean? I watch a show on television and everything they say about Africa is negative. You know? And that's just to reinforce these stereotypes and to keep the status going the way it is. Because while they're reaping Africa, and at the same time, a lot of Europeans are moving to Africa and they're trying to get the Africans out. Not only with the AIDS epidemic, which they put there in the first place, you know, and the resources, you know, so... Yes, it's happened to me a few times, spiritually and physically.
It's right, because it like reinforces this message. You know, it's like the script. We're just kind of running through the script. And then so when you're handcuffed and taken off a bus and people around see this, it just reinforces the script and the message in the mind. Of because, I mean, at the end of the day, no one knows what you did, if you did or didn't do something. They just see you being taken off a bus in handcuffs, and then it just reinforces this image and the message.
Yeah, you're guilty before charged.
I had a similar experience, actually.
Have you? Mm-hmm. What happened?
Well, the last, it was 5 years ago. It was 2001. And I was in back and forth doing community work in Massachusetts. I was on my way back to Massachusetts, which was just outside of Boston, Worcester, Massachusetts. And... I was dressed, I guess you could call it, very Afrocentrically. I had my mud cloth and everything, and I don't know. I was the only black person on the bus, and the people got on the bus and everything, and I'm born in Montreal, so I mean, you know, I thought, okay, hey, if they take me off the bus, they're going to check my passport, whatever, it's cool, you know? So they took me off the bus, and I remember there was about maybe 30 to 35 people on the bus, and I was sitting in the front, right? And they took me off the bus, and they brought me to the back. I was at the Canadian-U.S. border. They brought me to the back to check my file and everything. And I had no problem. I gave my passport. And they asked me, how long have I been in Canada? And I said, well, I've been in Canada all my life. And they're like, well, you look like, you know, maybe you just came from, you know, Africa or whatever. I said, no, I didn't just come from Africa. So even though I would have liked to or whatever. But anyways, so they checked my file and everything so on. And they told me that they were checking my file for at least 15 minutes. And I remember in high school, you know, you're leaving, you know, you're growing up and so on. At the time, I was 25. And I remember... Before I had a old shoplifting record, you know, when you're young, you're shoplifting, whatever. And it was from 18. But they refused me to enter into the U.S. based on a record I had from 18 years old. And I tried to ask them, you know, how can that be possible? Because, I mean, this is something that, you know, I went to court and everything and it was passed. But they said, I have a record and I'm not allowed to pass into the U.S. or whatever. And I started to make up a little bit of noise and they told me, if you want to be arrested, you know, you can continue, but you're going to be arrested. So I just let it go or whatever. And I took a taxi back to Montreal. And they gave me a paper saying that I can't come back to the U.S. for 5 years. Which now it has, right now, it's the 5 years is up. And I called the U.S., you know, the U.S., it was right before the September 11th business, 2000, actually, yeah. So what happened is that they said that they refused me entry, and I'm trying now to get my papers back together, whatever, but there's a problem, because they're telling me now I have to pay something like $1,000-something to get a waiver for something that is really ridiculous, because why was I stopped in the first place, you know what I mean?
How long ago was that?
That was 2000, a little bit before 2001 and so on. But, you know, I just figured maybe it's a blessing. Maybe I'm not supposed to go to the U.S. at all, you know?
True.
Kentucky, you were just talking before the show, before the show started, that you had some experiences within the healthcare system also. Mm. On racial discrimination and profiling. Could you talk about that too?
Well, yeah, sure. Well, first of all, I just wanted to add that to get a little introduction, being raised here and being grown up here and everything, that I went to school here. I went to school in the system here.
Yeah.
And I wasn't raised in the hood or anything like that. I was raised in a middle-class neighborhood. I was raised in the South Shore. So it's nothing about, you know, being raised in the ghetto, because I didn't know anything about that.
Yeah.
But I was still black, you know? And as I still am now. Thank God. Anyway, so basically what happened is that being raised in that kind of system, I remember, like, you know, being the only black child in school, and or being the only, you know, being the only black child in school, or being one of a few black children in school, and, you know, the other black girls usually wanting to hang around with, you know, the white girls or whatever, or wanting to have, you know, there's not really having a sense of
pride or
not yet. Yeah. I wouldn't say pride, because I was raised in a Caribbean home, so that was always there. You know, it's not the pride thing,
but a sense of place. That's how I felt too.
A sense of place, exactly. But the pride issue was never something with me. You know, but basically, I mean, in grade three, I remember, because I was always, my father was a Pan-Africanist, so I was raised, I mean, for a very short time as a Pan-Africanist, and those values have stayed within me, and some of his teachings stayed within me very strongly, and, you know, I had an attention problem, you know, and everything like that, because I was, you know, raised with certain principles that was not being taught, I was not being taught at the school. So the teachers decided in grade three that I have an attention deficit problem, and I'm, like, retarded or something, and they wanted me to get a brain scan.
Yeah.
And they sent my mother a letter, and thank God my mother is a very educated woman. She refused the letter and everything like that. So they placed me in a, like, dumb class and everything, like retarded or whatever class.
Special class.
And I was, you know, placed in that class, and, you know, having problems going in and out of different schools and, you know, and everything like that. So that was, like, I mean, the whole racial profiling thing has been part of my whole history from the induction from me into the school system. It has been constant. So this is not something that just happened. It's been my whole life, you know? So basically, after that, about the healthcare system, I'm going to skip to that. I had a midwife for my son's birth, and I wanted a natural birth and everything like that. And I was even considering going to the Caribbean, but that was another thing. So I decided to have, I was signed up with the Maison de Naissance, which is on Côte de Neige. And I had a midwife and everything, and she was very great. She was from Tunisia. She was amazing, and she was very, you know, she was just amazing, you know. And then, unfortunately, I was transferred to the hospital. I was transferred, and the hospital that they deal with is a Jewish general. But I took time. I took about 2 months to do my birth plan. I had one copy to my doula, which was my good friend, and I had four copies. I had one to my sister, one to my doula, one to my partner, one to the doctor, one to the nurse. I mean, I made sure this was all organized and stuff. And I told them I wanted certain things done, you know? And as someone who is very much in tune with, you know, ancestral traditions and so on, I wanted to do something very ritualistic, very, you know, in tune with my ancestors. And I wanted to, like, light a candle and do a prayer and everything like that. They told me, okay, none of that can happen here. You can't do that here.
Within the hospital.
And, you know, I wanted to tie my head because it's part of my tradition. You know, it's part of my ancestral tradition. I wanted to, you know, do the things the way I wanted to do them. You know, I wanted certain people there, and that was okay. The people there was okay. But the whole thing with me being able to, I mean, they wanted to know why I wanted to do this. What is this? Is this some kind of a ritual or something? And I mean, even if it is a ritual, what is your business?
Right.
You know what I mean? Yeah. I'm of African descent. I mean, I can do whatever. Even if it is a ritual,
it's my right as a Canadian citizen too.
Exactly. Yeah. So anyways, they basically, what happened was that I gave the birthing plan, and I was in labor for quite a long time. And what happened was that I told them that I didn't want any, I think it's student nurses or student doctors touching me. I just want one nurse touching me and a female. I don't want any males touching me, you know, and or coming to look at me or anything like that. So what happened was that, and the birth plan was there and everything, and they could see it. What happened was that during the course of the time, I did have one nurse with me and so on. And I said I didn't want, you know, certain things. I didn't want intravenous. I didn't want, I had this mask over my face. I didn't want that either. And I was reassured by the midwives that, you know, that might, you know, I would have the ability to not be forced to do these things. So anyways, what ended up happening is that I ended up having four student nurses and doctors sticking their fingers in my womb and just be like, okay, lie down, you know, it's going to be okay. Like, And I was like, oh, wonderful, you know. Yeah. You know, slavery all over again. You know, slavery 2006, you know. And I said, okay, well, you know, I just chilled out or whatever. I tried to, you know, meditate within myself. And yeah. I ended up being brought to the cesarean emergency section and everything like that. And I told him that at least, you know, I wasn't sure, but maybe I didn't really do the research that I thought I had done as well. As I should have. And what happened was that I did end up having the cesarean, and I was whisked off to the to the recovery room and everything. And it was just like totally crazy because everything was happening and they weren't explaining to me anything, you know what I mean? And then afterwards, the next day, everything went well. I had my baby, everything was fine. And he was with his father while I was in the recovery room. And then what happened the next day is that the doctor came. And she said to me, well, because she saw my birth. I had two doctors that were being followed. I was being followed, who were following me during that course of the time when I was at the Jewish. And she said, well, she brought me my birthing plan, the copy. And she said, so is it as bad as you thought it was going to be? She said, we didn't kill you, did we?
Hmm.
And I said, what kind of bitch is this?
Yeah.
You know? Like, who did you know? Yeah. I mean... And then a couple of hours later, the other doctor came and asked me, we'd just like to know in your file, what kind of birth control are you planning on using? And I'm in my mid-30s.
Yeah.
This is my first child.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So, I mean, I'm not, you know, some breeding machine or something, you know? So I was just wondering, like, you know, what kind of birth control am I planning on using? We just wanted to know. We have various birth controls that you can, you know, consider. I said, well, right now, I guess I'll just be using, I don't know. He said, you don't know? I said, no. And he stood up looking at me like, well, maybe you better know type of vibration. Yeah. And I was like, okay, well, okay, have a good day. And he just left because I tried to let him know, like, okay, it's time for you to exit, you know?
Yeah.
And he just, I mean, it seemed to me that it was like, you know, basically what kind of birth control are you using? Maybe we can put you on Depo Provera or something. Maybe we can work something out. And, you know. Basically, and then the people next to me who were like, but beside me, she, you know, I mean, whenever she saw me coming, she would always be whisking her, closing her blinds because she doesn't want me to look at her baby, you know. And every time I'm back, she's like, you know, closing it like really fast, you know. And I was like, whoa, you know. And even the like Brother Zibbs was saying, even the vibration that I felt from the people, even the black women. It doesn't mean that because, you know, even the black woman, the joy that I felt, I was obviously overjoyed, my first child, you know, in my mid-30s and everything. And it's just the vibration that I felt from people, like, it's like, it was almost like, who, you know, like, what do you do, like, type of thing, like, I'm not supposed to feel joy, or it was not natural for me to feel so much joy.
Based on the way you were dressed and the activities that you wanted to surround your birthing experience.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, and so from the get-go, you know, from that first experience from giving birth in a Western institution, which was against my will, which was what I did not plan. It was a preparation for me for what it's going to be like, you know, as a mother in a system that doesn't expect me to be a loving mother.
Actually, I want to ask you about that. Now that your son is 11 months old, and what hopes and fears do you have after these experiences for him?
Well, I don't have any fear for him
because
I know the Most High is with me. I don't have any fear for him. And I always keep in mind, and I tell all my sisters this in the community, that what we experience is only a quarter or maybe a third of what our ancestors experienced. Mm. So if you think what you're feeling is bad, imagine the woman, you know, in the cabin who's like, you know, imagine what our ancestors had to go through.
Yeah.
You know, not even slavery, but before that, you know what I mean? With the fall of empires and seeing that what they had built was destroyed, you know what I mean? Mm. So, I mean, it's nothing what I'm going through. It's really nothing. It's just a piece of the cake, you know? And in terms of what aspirations I have for him, definitely raising him in a Pan-African ideals and him not introducing him to certain, you know, Eurocentric kinds of mentality. He's not going to be exposed to a lot of things because I'm his mother, you know, that's clear, you know. And number two, I mean, part of my plan is repatriation, you know. And that's part. He's not going to grow here beyond the age of 10. So that's not my concern. And I think that's the only thing that I can do for him. And that's the best thing I can do for him.
Thank you for sharing your experience with us, Kentucky and Neil.
Marcus Garvey was right. I said Marcus Garvey was right. Yeah, in the way that, you know, repatriation, not only on a physical sense, but it must be on a mental and a spiritual sense, because you can never change who you are. You know, and they talk about assimilation in the society, but what do they really mean? You know, when you go to school and you do all that you're supposed to do and you're still rejected and treated like 3/5 human being, as they're trying to keep that up. So Marcus Garvey was right. You can only truly be empowered unless you're dealing with your language, your culture, and your land. This is native land still. So all the folks say have to leave.
All right. Well, on that note, we're going to take a short musical break here on Off the Hour. And more discussion about racial profiling.
Looking on various street corners, I'm sure you've seen it yourself, standing on the corner is an alleged brother dressed in blue or green, red, and black, and spouting the news that the revolution is coming and you better get ready, sort of like the end of the world is coming. Unfortunately, the world is just going to drag on and on. And we have a poem that we've written particularly for the brothers on the street corners.
Yo, standing on porches in front of houses and corner stores. I'm born to more horrifics and syphilis, cause where we live is hell on earth. Where was heaven when shit's real? We sold dope to get meals while white folk can sniff fields. Fuck Israel, it's kill hills. Spill pills for my bills, write wills for my seeds to live from. Take some, give some, for brothers that was lynch hung. The symptoms never go away or stow away for colder ways. Having ravenous savages, blasphemous, asking us whole crosses. It's more of us in Florida, oranges and lost orphans. I offer thought for food and full courses. I'm soaring toward the night glow, my hat's low, my roots grow. For you to soon know, I reap what you sow.
We just land down from Liberia. Young black man in control of the pillars. Millions buried in dirt. How many railroads do you own? How much clean chrome you own? It's for my ancestors named engraved in stone. On the roads that the rebels once roamed, we built homes, civilized our own. King Solomon Childs, beautiful as black this time. We will walk on water this time. We will see through the lies this time. Prepare troops to move in, expand the runways, build bigger bridges, 9 millimeters from Britain. We living in war, so prepare for submission. Apache helicopters, a black man's face on a dollar.
Word.
The pigs constantly watch us, the streets is obnoxious. Baby, you're the first, not homie, I'm toxic.
Gotta, the first seed of a dope fiend, she ADD. Needle park off spring, bourgeoisie wannabe. While her siblings is rich living, she ain't bitching. Mama's working 2 jobs trying to maintain the living. Few years past, now she getting raised by the streets. Side by side watching hustles, now she blaze like the streets. This is for my women living in the struggle. Getting brought into this world without asking for the troubles of the everyday life. Life. A battered wife, single mothers holding it down. Why the world so trife? Crack fiend, you could have been something better in life. Now hold your head up, ma, you know it ain't over, right? Yeah, this is for my Russians on the grind. Off the boat, struggling, trying to hold a 9 to 5. Yeah, I seen enough with these eyes. I thank the Most High, I'm still alive.
What the definition of racial profiling to you?
People will see you different once you come from another country or outside border they never saw. Mm-hmm. So let's say, I'm from Morocco. Mm-hmm. I'm Arab. So if I go to the States, okay, and I tell them that I'm Arab, they will see me in another way. And if I go back to Africa, as in Nigeria, and I say I'm Moroccan, you feel me? So
yeah.
It always depends where you're from. People see you, people judge you by the way you look, by the way you are, by the way that you come from, you know? But basically, they don't take the time to really say what's on your mind. Example is everyday lifestyle happens. Let's say me and a couple of friends, you know, a couple of Arabs, a couple of black people, you know, immigrants, we're hanging together, you know. We go to the park, whatever, and there's police passing by. So first thing the police sees is we're a bunch of like dark skin, brown skin, black skin. Mm-hmm. So they would say we have more chance to be looking like criminal than we actually were chemicals or, you know, white skin. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So people think that immigrants, once they're not from here, you know, they can't follow the rule from here.
Hmm. And what you consider a criminal?
Me, criminal for me is more than just going to the store and thieving, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Criminal is taking people's rights.
And you would say that racial profiling falls on the
table? Criminal.
Ah, I hear you, man. Well, but let me ask you something. Could you, as a Moroccan youth, an African youth, an Arab youth, can you affect the way a white person, their life, by you just not liking them because they're white? Can you just by just like sitting on the corner with your boys, or just like you sitting there and say, well, you know, I don't like that guy because he's white. Do you think that you have the power to affect his life, like stop?
No. I don't think so.
You're okay. But does the cops have the power to affect your life?
They have, because they're the government.
Okay. So in other words, the racism is not necessarily like a prejudice or personal prejudice. It's more a systematic
thing. Yeah, it's a system. It's the whole unit.
Okay, well, why do you think that we come here?
In my country, people go to university and they end up with no job. But here, it's impossible. You go to university, everywhere they want to take you.
Uh-huh. But I know there's some cases where some people, you know, with big degree here who are also brown skin, black skin, and they can't get a job.
Yeah, that's true.
So what are we going to do now when all the immigrants come here now and are highly educated and there is nothing for them to do? You think we go back to our country? You think it's going to be reversed?
Like my dad always told me, is since we're immigrants, we have to always work twice as hard than people from here.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, we come from another place, so we have to work somewhere like twice as much so we come like them. You know, we follow the same.
What happens when you're here for like another 20 years, another 30 years? What are you going to teach your children? Are we going to in turn come like the way the Quebecers are today?
Immigrants, no matter where the country they're from, they always continue their own. You know, they might have a little bit of Quebecers culture, but they still have their own cultures.
Okay, let me add something to that now. To gang, who you think is the biggest gang? Just like your own thought, not what the news say or what John say, or who you think is the biggest gang, like really and truly? You're an intelligent brother. Who is you think is the biggest gang?
You know, I chill in the street. I know a lot of people, and I would say it's black people, Arab people, and Latino people are the most people that are in gangs here.
And what kind of gangs are we talking about? What are they dealing with?
We're talking about drugs,
mm-hmm.
guns,
mm-hmm.
girls, prostitution, everything. And me, basically, I don't think they're doing that because they're not smart enough or whatever. It's just the government don't give them that chance
mm-hmm.
for them to do, you know? Like, when they go in the street and they get stopped by the police, you know, that's like rage for them. They start hating them. And by thinking that, they think that by the gang and doing bad things, they're going to hurt them, but they're not. They're hurting their own self. If they want to make the government mad, they have to go to school, show them that they could do better than them. You know what I mean? That's what kids don't understand.
Okay. Education. But what if in what they're teaching you is, for lack of a better word, bullshit? What are you, like, for instance, like in Quebec here, when they talk about history, they never really mention the native people. Do you have an idea of the history of the native people?
No, they don't talk about native
people. You know?
talk about Quebec. The Quebec is our 101 story of Quebec, that's it.
So you think it's proper for us to just be sitting down in a class where we're just learning like one part of the story?
No.
You know, is that really education?
Phone. Welcome back to CKUT 90.3. You're listening to Off the Hour and a special two-hour live broadcast that we're doing from the Jeunesse 2000 Youth Drop-In Center in NDG. So we're listening to youth voices. We're listening to interviews with community activists and local groups about the issues of racial profiling and discrimination in Montreal. And we're joined now by Nicolas of Maison des Jeunes.
Hi, how's it going?
Good, how are you?
I'm excellent.
All right, so you've had a lot of experiences, not just in Canada, but around the world, dealing with these issues. So why don't you give us a bit of your background, and we'll go from there.
Okay, I come from what you would call a red diaper family from South America, from Argentina. My parents were, I don't know, socially conscious people, and in their generation, there was a lot of repression. There was a period called the Dirty War, where many of my father's colleagues and people in very much the same position that I'm now, with the kind of work that I'm doing, where they were being picked up by paramilitary groups, basically tortured and executed. And it's a long, long, really depressing history. That's why I'm a Canadian citizen, Canada. And I traveled around the world. I lived in Africa for 5 years, in Eastern Europe for 4 years, in Central America for 4 years, and I'm back here in Montreal, and I work in Côte des Neiges, which is, I think, actually the most multicultural borough mm-hmm. in the world. There's some 140 different nations represented there. It's like the United Nations, bigger than the United mm-hmm. Nations. And in terms of racial profiling as an issue, I think Zibs touched on it, and it's an everyday thing, and it's stratified within all communities, because we all coexist on some level and we all participate in kind of our own demise as well as our own upbringings. And as a youth worker, I work with Algerian youth, Laotian youth, Filipino youth, Russian youth, Quebecer youth, as now it's a nation, so yeah. Anglophone Canadian youth. I find our biggest problem in terms of racial profiling is that a lot of the older generations have marked certain territories. And sometimes I don't necessarily think it's as much as race, as much as it's social class and hierarchy. Mm-hmm. I think our biggest priority as a society as a whole has always been money and economy. So within each community, I mean, in Argentina, you'll find in the poorest communities, the poorest man being spat on by the next tier of mm-hmm. poverty, and so forth and so forth. It's stratified. So it really starts with how you treat other people and how you regard your own position and what you take for granted or what you don't take for granted. And Côte des Neiges is a place, just like NDG, for example, where you have a lot of youth who don't have a lot of resources. Mm-hmm. So we're organizing an event called Youth Uprising. It's on the 17th of December, and we're trying to connect these two boroughs, which have had a lot of conflict. It's been a history. Kids are born in NDG, mm-hmm. born to dislike kids in Côte des Neiges, mm-hmm. and vice versa. And it goes all the way from Côte des Neiges also to Little Burgundy. And the funniest thing about this is that one of the more higher concentrations of Anglophone communities, mm-hmm. and that's also a bigger problem in the province of Quebec, and the division between not only culture or class and race, but also language. So we're trying to sanctify, you know, a space